Recording. Got it.
Okay. Super. So it's my understanding that this summer you have been studying spirituality as it is practiced, reminding each other of Socrates' sage words captured by Plato, that life which is unexamined is not worth living. This mindfulness is what I call intentional living, and it is at the heart of Socrates' command to know thyself. The kind of self-knowledge that Socrates and his student Plato were talking about was not information, such as, I know that I'm April, I'm 48-year-old female, mother, wife, daughter, sister, professor, and so on. It is deeper knowledge than this. It is coming face-to-face with my deepest aspect, the ground of my being. In the language of religion, it is my personal encounter with God, my experience of that which is sacred. It is a kind of knowledge that is at the heart of Gnostic spirituality, which we are exploring today. For many of us in the UU tradition, the word spirituality has superseded the word religion, because we have such an aversion to creeds and rituals which we attribute to other religious institutions but not ourselves. We encourage spiritual journeying while not so much religious adherence. We think of religious people as those people other than ourselves who belong to religions like Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, so forth. While we are non-religious, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, so forth, humanists, Wiccans, who are on a spiritual journey together. I did not give this distinction too much thought until my son Alexander came home from school last year and asked me what we were. His friends at school were Christian, they were Jewish, they were Muslim, they were Hindi, they were Buddhist. He was being pressured. Were we Christians too? He asked me. For most of my life, I have struggled with this same question myself. In fact, I remember clearly the day my struggle began. It is vivid green summer, and my sister's best friend has just left in the car with her mother, Jerry. We are standing on the lawn, my mom and I. My mother turns to me and tells me that we will be joining Jerry's church, the church of my mom's own childhood. She says that she does not want us to be raised without God. The time has come for her own spiritual, personal renewal and for her children's spiritual induction. Now I am perplexed deeply, profoundly. Up until this moment in my life, we have had no need for God talk or churches. We have no need for God. Mustering all the boldness I dare as a 10-year-old, I asked her, God, what are you talking about? Does such a thing as God exist? And how would you even know? She responds without a moment's hesitation, that is something I cannot tell you. That is something you will have to discover for yourself. If air could crystallize, it did at that moment. For a second, colors and sound intensified. The green of the grass, the blue of the sky, stillness invaded. It was a moment that transfixed me as I suddenly faced a spiritual fullness where before there had been nothing. It came unbidden in the crevice of a second, and it reoriented my life. Over the next 3 years in that church, we prayed to God as our Father, Mother God, whom we worshiped as all goodness, mind, life, truth, love, and intelligence. The human Jesus was the Christ, the divine reflection of God. He was sent by God to teach and model for us God's truth. Because God is good, we were instructed. It is never God's will for any of us to suffer, to be sick, or to die. The nature of our real selves is spirit. The material world and its ills are illusions, projections of distorted beliefs, shadows of our real nature. With the right spiritual orientation and prayer, our illnesses could be vanquished, our suffering could vanish. At our Wednesday night meetings, we heard firsthand testimonies of people being cured of colds, flus, stomach aches, headaches, and even warts. But about the big diseases like cancer, we remained hushed. I watched a woman in our congregation slowly die as a tumor on her neck and shoulder grew untreated. She used to wear silk scarves around her neck to hide the tumor. But the cancer's bulk was visible beneath like a scarlet A. And then there were other people like my mother who had chronic incurable diseases that were less visible. She was a juvenile diabetic, insulin dependent. One night I went into my parents' bedroom to give my mother a kiss goodnight. She had gone to bed early, not feeling well. When I leaned over to kiss her, I noticed how listless and pale she was. I was terrified, instantly aware that she was not ill from a virus, but that something far more serious was going on. I sat down on the bed and began pleading with her, "What was going on? Did you forget to take your insulin? Did you eat too much sugar?" She told me that she had been praying for a healing, that she couldn't understand what she had done wrong. She had gone without her insulin for a couple of days. Why hadn't God healed her? She wept with guilt. At that moment, I did not care about the whys or wherefores of spiritual healing. I only cared that my mom would not lose consciousness and die. Instantly, I was faced with the reality of her body and her disease, no matter what the church had taught me. She must have heard the terror in my voice as I made her promise to never refuse her insulin again. She stayed true to her promise. We immediately withdrew our membership from the Christian Science Church and abandoned its dangerous stance against materialism. From that point on, we became religious seekers, looking for a spiritual home within the dizzying array of generic Protestant options. But I was never comfortable when the Protestants insisted, like the Catholics, that God allowed the sacrifice of his own son for our sins, that as a part of God's plan, Jesus died to cure the depravity that is our fallen human nature. I struggled with the belief that human nature was perverted by an ancestor's disobedient act, and that because of this, humans are incapable of doing good outside the grace of God. I was disturbed that the dominant Christian story revolved around a human sacrifice, which I could not help but see as a gruesome act of domestic violence against a child by his father. I questioned whether this father was the kind of God that any of us should want to model or worship. One might think that at this point I abandoned Christianity altogether, but this is not what happened. Because I felt deeply guilty for not being able to buy into the central Christian message. So I kept going around to different Protestant churches and revival meetings, hoping that I would find a place where I would fit. This never happened. Instead, as I graduated from high school and entered college, I became frustrated with all the biblical preaching, literalism, and quotes that the religiously convicted bandied about as if this settled the issues. The issues weren't settled for me. On the one hand, I could not reconcile an all-loving provincial God with the reality of suffering, disease, and disaster and evil in our world. On the other hand, I could not comprehend devoting myself to a God of violence who would permit the murder of his own child. I was weary from being told that I had to believe in the sacrifice in order to be saved. I was confused by the constant message that I was a sinner, while personally feeling that I was living a decent moral life, infused with God's presence. Why didn't I fit? What was going on with Christianity when teachings about humanity's original blessedness and the need for at-one-ment with an all-loving God were considered heretical, while teaching about humanity's original sin and the need for atonement and blood sacrifice was deemed orthodox? Questions like these eventually pressed me into graduate school, where I trained to be a historian of the ancient Near East and the Bible, and now, 25 years later, compel me to write my newest book, The Ancient New Age, which is about the birth of Christianity and the internal struggles that came to define it and continue to do so. While the struggles that the new Christian religion faced were far more complex than we will ever be able to map, it has become clear to me that the struggles at the most basic level revolved around polar opposite concepts of the human being and God. On the one hand, the early Catholic Christians were fixated on re-engineering traditional Jewish teachings about the mortality of the human being who had been created in God's image but was subject to sin and death on account of human disobedience to a legalistic God. But other Christians were not so inclined. They were preoccupied with the teachings of Greek philosophy, particularly Plato, and retrofitting them to their experience as Christians. They understood the essential human being to be an uncreated piece of God the good. The essential human was living in exile on earth, suffering miserably on account of the separation and yearning for reintegration into God. These Christians were called Gnostics, or knowers. Their view of humanity and God was nothing less than revolutionary, challenging and transgressing traditional belief, shaking the very foundation of conventional religion in antiquity. To explain how Gnostic spirituality formed, we begin in a world long before the start of Christianity. We begin with the classroom, within the classroom of Plato, with a word that had absolutely nothing to do with religion or with people at all. The word Gnostic was invented by Plato as an adjective of the word gnosis, knowledge. Gnosis referred to the type of knowledge that was not practical knowledge about things. It was experiential knowledge of things. It's like the difference between the statements, I know about you, or I know you. Plato created the technical term Gnostic to refer to a type of understanding that's theoretical, rather than the type of understanding that is practically applied in crafts, like knowing what to do as a carpenter, having experience as a carpenter. The Platonists used it to describe our mental capacity to know something rather than to know how to do something. Got that distinction? All right, hold on to it. This word in the second, in the first and second century becomes applied to religious people. Who were these religious people? The first Gnostics were Alexandrian pagans and Jews who were being inducted into the great Egyptian mysteries of Hermes Thoth. What happened as a result of their initiation experiences and their re-examination of the Jewish scriptures is nothing less than a revolution in spirituality. It was a transformation in the way that people thought about their deepest values and existential concerns and lived their lives. It was an upheaval in their metaphysical orientation which realigned their lives. It was the birth of Gnostic spirituality. I liken it to a revolution in scientific thought when the emergent ideas of a thinker like Ptolemy, Newton, or Einstein utterly alter the way we perceive the world and how humans fit in it. Nothing is the same afterward. And so it was with the emergence of Gnostic spirituality in the first century. Prior to its existence, there were three main types of spirituality that dominated the religious scene. all of these types of spirituality conceive the human being and God to be vastly different, both in terms of their substance and in terms of their power. All three of these types of spirituality fostered the religions around the Mediterranean and in turn were nurtured by them. And you will recognize each one of these, I'm sure. The oldest of these types is servant spirituality. It is a metaphysical orientation that understands the human being as a mortal creature made by a powerful being or God for the sole purpose of serving that God and that God's desires. The human being relates to the God out of fear and obligation, not love or respect. This type of spirituality fostered all of the religions in the ancient Mediterranean, from Babylonia to Greece to Egypt to the Israelite religion. Servant spirituality was reframed by the Jews following the destruction of the Jerusalem temple in the year 586. They were destroyed by the Babylonians and taken to Babylon. And in Babylonia, the priests actually wrote the Torah. Okay, so during the process of writing that book, they reflected on their experience of having their temple destroyed and essentially their God overpowered by the Babylonian God. And so they needed to be able to explain this. And they explained it as they wrote. They insisted as they wrote that their God, Yahweh, who had created them as mortals, was also a powerful king who had contracted with them as an elect people to protect them and their land as long as they followed his laws. If they disobeyed his laws, they would face divine retribution. The human being relates to God in this covenant spirituality, first out of fear and obligation, and second out of repentance and supplication. The third spirituality in the ancient world is mystic spirituality. Central to this metaphysical orientation is the perception that human beings cannot fully comprehend God. In order to learn about God's intentions, humans must rely on revelation gained through rapture, a prophet's teaching, divination, or some kind of personal experience like a soul journey. The human being interacts with God as a supplicant who dreads a being far superior, but also as a worshiper who is in awe of a mystery beyond human cognition. Gnostic spirituality is the revolution that charged on the scene in the first century. The ancient Gnostics were among the first people to insist that our true nature as human beings is deeper than our physical bodies or even our human psyches or souls. The word soul, we translate soul actually in Greek as psyche. And we all know psychology, mind, that's what the soul is. Many of them understood it to be deeper than our minds and our conscious mental processes. Human beings are more than mortal creatures, they felt. The essential human self, our authentic being, is nothing less than God's very own life essence, his own life breath or spirit captured deep within the human psyche, dormant, unexpressed, and forgotten. It suffers in the state of isolation, latency, and stupor. It lies there pained, waiting to be awakened, cultivated, and reunited with its source. Only such an immediate mystical encounter with God can ease its suffering and restore its integrity. Cognitive linguists today are very interested in understanding how humans successfully innovate, how we come up with new ideas and concepts like the Gnostic and transmit it to others. To explain the process, they use the framed picture as a metaphor. A concept, they say, is like a picture in a frame that we use to structure our thoughts while we are thinking. The frame structures our idealized picture of the concept. When we think, we compare our mental frame of the concept with our personal experience of it. And this allows us to think and communicate about the concept. As a society, we hold in common the vast majority of our mental frames. They are learned from our experiences living within the society. They are stored in our personal memories as well as in the physical artifacts like art, literature, architecture, and so forth that we've created to represent them. It is the shared nature of the mental frames that allows us to communicate with each other effectively and intelligibly. The ancient Gnostic revolution represents the emergence of a new mental frame, Gnostic spirituality, and it restructured the way people thought about metaphysics and engaged religious practice. What are the elements that were blended to create this new frame? This revolution in spirituality was the result of compressing five basic ideas into a new concept. First, the Gnostic is someone who possesses knowledge, the knower. But he possesses or she possesses this personally. It is not knowledge about God, it is becoming acquainted with God directly, as in saying, I know God, I've experienced God. This mystical encounter reintegrates the essential human being into its divine ground in an experience of wholeness or unity. Third, the Gnostic believes in an innate spiritualness, that the essential nature of the human being derives directly from the divine and is good. Fourth, the Gnostic message is a transgressive message. It is not just different from the standard opinion. It critiques standard doctrine to the point that it overturns it. The Gnostic message is transgressive in that it is viewed by conventional Jews and Christians as heretical and dangerous. This results in subversive systems, myths, doctrines, and practices among Gnostics. Fifth, Gnostic spirituality is characterized by a seekership outlook and a quest orientation that is focused on serious metaphysical questions. The quest for answers to perennial existential dilemmas is inclusive, spanning vast philosophical and religious territories and negotiating a new identity across them. Religious pluralism is at the heart of Gnostic spirituality. In the ancient world, the Gnostic was a new phenomenon. It referenced a religious person and a perspective that was at once intellectual and revelatory, categories that traditional religions often view oppositionally. For the first time in history, it understood religion to be a personal human journey to alleviate our suffering and isolation by addressing our ultimate concerns, our deepest yearnings, and profoundest experiences through myth and ritual. Religions that were generated from the forge of Gnostic spirituality were not about civic and family duty. They were not a contest in appeasement or a placation of a god to be feared. They were not premised on attempts to secure a god's favor and recognition. They were about the renewal of the human as God. Let me say that again. They were about the renewal of the human as God and the welding of this power to forge a better life in the here and now and forever after. While various ancient Gnostic groups and systems emerged as expressions of this new type of spirituality, but ultimately failed to perpetuate themselves, there is only one remaining ancient Gnostic group in the modern world, and those are the Mandeans. And for those of you interested, there's quite a large group of Mandeans now in the diaspora that live in San Antonio. So they failed to perpetuate themselves, but this cognitive frame I spoke about earlier remains in our culture. The Gnostic in this way triumphs historically, remaining a vital aspect of Western culture and critique of Christianity even today. In fact, it is my opinion that this Gnostic frame forms the bedrock of Unitarian Universalism, with roots as far back as Ralph Waldo Emerson, who lived in the 1800s. Emerson began his career as a Unitarian minister after graduating from Harvard Divinity School. But within just a few years, he left his post at Second Church in Boston when he could no longer in good conscience hold the rite of communion. He felt that traditional Christianity, including Unitarianism, was antiquated, worshiping in the dead forms of its forefathers. He was particularly concerned that Unitarianism had sacrificed the soul of religion by focusing so exclusively on rationalism and logic that the spirit of Christianity was no longer alive within the churches. Emerson called for the reintegration of mystical experience into the Unitarian churches of his time. This urgent call came from the depths of his own mystical experience of oneness with the universe and nature. He writes in his essay in 1836, his essay on nature, quote, "Our age is retrospective. It builds the sepulchres of the fathers. It writes biographies, histories, and criticism. The foregoing generations, they beheld God and nature face to face. We through their eyes. Why should not we also enjoy an original relation to the universe?" Emerson went into the woods to find this original relation to the universe. He writes about his, quote, "transcendent moment," when in the woods he felt that nothing could happen to him that nature could not repair. Quote, "Standing on the bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am part and particle of God." In his famous address to the graduating class of the Harvard Divinity School in 1838, he lamented that, quote, "the base doctrine of the majority of voices usurps the place of the doctrine of the soul," unquote. He told, just imagine being there, he's preaching to would-be Unitarian ministers. He told the would-be Unitarian preachers that they should avoid touting secondhand instruction from the pulpits that had deadened the churches. They should become provocateurs instead, announcing what we each must find to be true within ourselves. What is this truth, this intuitive faith that Emerson suggested? It was his call to, quote, and here he's playing with Socrates, "obey thyself." Remember what did Socrates say? Know thyself. Obey thyself. Emerson was convinced that the essence of religion was not the reason doctrine created by men, but the intuition of moral sediment within each of us, what he understood to be our souls. He thought that this intuitive sentiment is divine and deifying. It is what makes the human being illimitable by showing the fountain of all good to be in himself. This is the soul which never reasons, never proves, but simply perceives. Quote, "it is vision." Emerson insisted that spiritual truth can only be had when we trust ourselves and our own intuitions, what he called self-reliance. Quote, "nothing is at last sacred," Emerson says, "but the integrity of our own mind." He reveled in being the transgressor, the nonconformist, the misunderstood, who lived deeply from within himself to challenge the authorities with spontaneity and instinct. He abhorred the person who he called timid and apologetic, who dared not say, "I think," or "I am," but rather quote some ancient sage. He writes with vigor, quote, "let us stun and astonish the intruding rabble of men and books and institutions by a simple declaration of divine fact. Bid the invaders take the shoes from off their feet, for God is here within." To the shock and dismay of his Christian contemporaries, Emerson collapsed the traditional gap between God and the human being by insisting that God is the, quote, dread universal essence that infuses the human being and connects us with all. He was declared a heretic. While he never defined himself as a Gnostic, his transgressive spirituality was exactly that. Emerson had moved far beyond the wrathful and controlling God of his Puritan ancestors and their covenant spirituality. He had also left behind the more benevolent God and servant spirituality that the Unitarians of his day had reasoned out of the Christian scriptures. Rather, Emerson envisioned God and the human being as one. The human being is a stream emerging from a source that is hidden. Our being, he explained in his essay, The Oversoul, in 1841, is descending into us from we know not whence. We live in succession, in division, in parts, in particles. Meantime, within us is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one. Emerson reshaped his former Unitarian beliefs to reflect this Gnostic spirituality that invigorated him, whether he knew it or not. He had read widely Neoplatonic texts, Hindu scriptures, the accounts of medieval Christian mystics, Sufic poetry, and German philosophy. Eventually, he, along with a number of Boston intellectuals, formed a religious movement, Gnostic spirituality, forming a religious movement, that came to be known as, do you know? Transcendentalism, exactly. Or, Emerson hated that word, he called it idealism. It was based on the philosophical claim of Kant that it is possible to know things that do not come to us through sense experience, but rather our intuitions in our minds. This knowledge is a class of ideas or transcendental forms that exist not because we've experienced them in our lives. Rather, they are ideals we intuit or know. Think of concepts like justice, love, beauty, those ideals. And we've never seen ideal beauty before, but somehow we intuit it. What is our intuition of ideal spirituality, the transcendentalists asked. According to them, intuitive spiritual truth is that God is one and immanent in nature and humanity. Transcendentalism reflected an eclectic theology that drew from the scriptures of many cultures. Emerson understood all of these scriptures. It could be the Vedas, it could be Christian scripture, it could be the Quran. He understood all of the scriptures to represent variations on the, quote, fundamental doctrine of the oversoul as the substrate of the soul and the universe. His study of the scriptures of the world's religions, combined with his own intuition and transcendent moment as the eyeball, led him to promote the belief in the one God who is source of all reality, whether that God was called Brahman, the universal fact, the ground of being, or the ultimate reality. Further, he believed in the unity of all things because he thought that all nature, including human beings, are representations of the transcendent reality. He drew strong criticism from the Christian establishment for his beliefs in the God within, the self-reliant individual, and the oversoul that transcends human reason and the senses. Yet his work with this Gnostic orientation survived and became instrumental in the shaping of American culture and religion broadly, and Unitarian Universalism particularly. We largely have Emerson to thank for our contemporary reformulation of Unitarian Universalism as a religion that draws on the direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to the renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces that create and uphold life. Emerson's transcendentalism provided the foundation for our contemporary understanding in this church of the inherent worth of every person and our insistence that each of us has the capacity to search for truth and meaning freely without relying on external authorities like priests or creeds or traditions. Instead, we rely on ourselves in our search for truth, our own reason, and our own experience. So what are we, Alexander? Like Emerson, spiritually, we are Gnostics who have transgressed traditional Christianity, critiquing the dead forms of religion that have preceded us. While we value reasonableness and logic over unexamined faith, we do not see this as the full story. Like Emerson and the Gnostics before him, we also value the direct experience of the transcendent, who we call by many names. Like Emerson and the Gnostics before him, we draw from the wisdom of many faiths, including Judaism and Christianity. We are inclusive seekers on a spiritual journey together. Yet our contemporary Gnostic spirituality does not continue to generate Emerson's transcendentalism. We are not transcendentalists. Rather, our contemporary Gnostic orientation has generated a distinct new religious movement of its own. So what are we? We are our own religion, distinct from all other religions in the world, including Christianity. So Alexander, while historically we were once Christians who thought that the doctrine of the Trinity was a farce, we no longer are believers affirming a Christian creed, even a Unitarian one. Instead, we are Gnostics who have left behind Christianity to forge a new religion called Unitarian Universalism. So the next time someone at school asks you what you are, tell that person, "I am a Unitarian Universalist and proud to be so." Thank you.